You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Estonian President Kersti Kaljulaid. I'd also like to offer my sincere gratitude on behalf of this institution to Alan and Jane Batkin for their tremendous support of this leadership series and for making events like this possible. I also want to recognize in our audience today that we have 16 Harvard students who are here for a workshop in Washington on European politics, democracy, and political theory. Welcome to you and welcome to everybody. Now, on my behalf, it's a pleasure at a personal level, not only an institutional level, to welcome today's two guests of honor, both of whom I had the pleasure of working with at the United Nations, one of whom is my former boss at the United Nations, and that is former United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and former President of Ireland, Mary Robinson. Secretary General Ban is now the vice chair of the Elders, and he served as two consecutive terms as Secretary General of the United Nations between 2007 and 2016. I had the privilege of working for him during most of his second term as Secretary General, and I can attest to the fact that he personifies the principles of the UN Charter and the integrity that we would expect in the leadership position like this. Prior to his time at the UN, he had a distinguished career in public service in South Korea for 37 years, which included serving as the Foreign Minister of Korea, South Korea between 2004 and 2006. Throughout his tenure as the UN Secretary General, in addition to all of the peace and security and other issues that he was working on, he focused on bringing climate change to the top of the global agenda. Starting with the 2007 Climate Change Summit, he has led diplomatic efforts to tackle these issues. And he continues to advocate for mitigating the effects of climate change and promoting sustainable development. He helped launch the Global Commission on Adaptation in 2018, and he's been working as the President of the Assembly and the chair of the Council of Global Green Growth Institute, the GGGI. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, welcome. President Robinson is the chair of the Elders, and she was president of Ireland between 1990 and 1997, the first woman to hold that position. She also served as the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights between 1997 and 2002. As the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mrs. Robinson witnessed the injustice in climate change and its disproportionate impact on the people of developing countries, especially women. She has since established a foundation focused on climate justice, and she served as the Secretary General's Special Envoy on Climate Change from 2014 to 2015. I had the privilege of witnessing her personal diplomacy in action when she also served as the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region of Africa, where she worked to put together mechanisms to bring the regional actors and domestic actors together to promote peace in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. In a few short moments, Secretary General Ban and President Robinson will share their remarks on the climate threat, the climate justice, and the role of global leadership as it relates to action on sustainable development. Their remarks will be followed by a discussion moderated by our own Dr. Jun Pak, who is the Senior Fellow in the Center for East Asia Policy Studies and our SK Korea Foundation Chair in Korea Studies. Jun hosted just recently a tremendous conference last month on climate change in Asia as part of the Asia Transnational Threats Forum series. And there's one quick reminder, as the cameras would indicate, this event is on the record, and it is being live webcast. And you can tweet about the event using hashtag climate leadership. It's now a real privilege to turn over the floor, the podium, to my former boss, former Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Secretary General, the podium is yours, and so is the audience.
Thank you, Ambassador Jeffrey Feltman, for your very kind words of introduction. I'm very pleased to meet my former colleagues at the United Nations, and also Ambassador Widman here. And I'd like to also recognize Chair of Korea Studies, Dr. Jung Park, and of course, my chairperson of the elders, President Mary Robinson, and distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be back to Washington, D.C., and also have an opportunity of speaking before you in the Brookings institutions, such highest level known global think tank. Thank you for inviting me here today, delivering a speech at the Brookings Institution, the world's foremost think tank, is always a great honor for me. Now, as a private citizen, I used to be here as a Secretary General and also Foreign Minister of the Republic of Korea. Today, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to discuss with you one of the two existential threats which humankind is facing and is going to face very seriously. That is, one is what I'm going to discuss with you, climate change, and the other is a nuclear possibility of a nuclear war, on which, as was introduced today, that I was honored to unveil the doomsday clock, whose hands is now moved to just 100 seconds before it reaches midnight. That is the closest ever in the history to the possibility of a doomsday. Many scientists stress, in fact, the reason behind unprecedented scale and destructiveness of Australian fires. This is a bushfire, but this has clearly very closely related to a climate crisis which we are now facing. So it is not the usual one, it's unusually serious one. As everybody will remember, in 2018, the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has again strongly warned to the world that unless we drastically contain the global temperature rise below 1.5 degrees Celsius, then there will be no hope. In fact, as you may remember, the Paris Climate Change Agreement agreed at 2 degrees Celsius. But soon, after 3 years, they realized that 2 degrees was not enough. So IPCC has made a special report. In fact, during the time of negotiation in Copenhagen and continuing negotiations until Paris, there was a strong argument that this agreement should be at 1.5 degrees. There were many heads of state and government and ministers coming from small island developing countries. They were even crying at the decision of 2 degrees. But that was the maximum at that time the world leaders were able to agree upon. So we agreed to be more practical and understanding the reality of some different views and positions of the countries. Now we realize that it must be completed and contained at 1.5 degrees. If we fail to miss all this kind of golden opportunity, I think this may be almost the last opportunity that we can live with this. Otherwise, if we just neglect accelerating our actions much, much harder, then you'll have to regret for all our succeeding generations. In that regard, as a former Secretary General of the United Nations and as a person who has spent 10 years passionately energizing and really trying to raise the awareness on the importance of addressing this climate change issues, I cannot but express my deepest concern that what is happening by the world leaders. We have to really do much, 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 much more. As part of the mandate, as you know, in 2015, there were two very important visions and agreements which were presented by the United Nations. One is the Sustainable Development Goals with 17 goals, so targeting by 2030. Then by 2030, there should be nobody who should suffer from abject poverty. And there should be nobody who should die needlessly from preventable diseases. And there should be no school children who should be left out of the schools. There are many, many issues and many promises, but I think this is the most ambitious and far-reaching visions that the United Nations has ever presented to the people of the world. Then it contains the climate change. One of the 17 goals include number 13 pillar, climate change. That is what I am going to really focus today and raising again and again the importance of this. I believe that, speaking in Washington, D.C., center of United States, and just near to White House, I cannot but express my deepest regret and even anger about what President Trump has decided to withdraw from this Paris Climate Change Agreement. This was signed by 197 state parties, four countries more than full member state of the United States. It has gone through very difficult. United States was the champion under President Obama to mobilize a sense of unity, working together with China, who was reluctant to join. But with my engagement and President Obama's political engagement, China and India decided to join this one. That is the reason why we are now having this Paris Agreement. I can just tell you that what President Trump has decided is politically very short-sighted and morally wrong and morally irresponsible. Even economically, it doesn't make any sense. When it comes to science, it is totally wrong. There is no such skeptics. There is no such deniers as there used to be. There used to be some skeptics, but there is absolutely no climate skeptics. It is happening much, much faster. It is approaching to us. If the agreement fails, and if we do not solve climate change, we will all be losers in the end. And thus, I strongly urge President Trump and his administration to return to climate change agreement as soon as possible. That's the urge of international community. That's the wish of all citizens around the world. Ladies and gentlemen, there is another issue which is very closely related with the climate change phenomena. That is air quality. Air pollution, particulate matter. As you already know, particulate matter air pollution is a dangerous threat in itself, but also due to its close relationship with climate change. The minuscule size of particulate matter allows it to enter the human body with ease, causing various illnesses such as respiratory disease, cardiovascular disease, a stroke, and even cancer. According to WHO, in particular, 92% of Asia-Pacific population, roughly covering 4 billion people out of 7.5 globally, are already exposed to high levels of air pollution. No region, no nation is safe from the threats of particulate matter. Again, according to WHO, 7 million people are dying needlessly from this effect affected by air pollution. You go many Southeast Asian countries and the African countries, you cannot just breathe. Even in my Korea, Republic of Korea, South Korea, one of the OECD countries, it's very difficult to breathe. People have been abusing their privilege of nature. Just the rapid process of industrialization, just they were running ahead just for industrialization without knowing that they were just abusing our privilege. Action against particulate matter cannot be pursued without addressing climate change as two sides of the same coin. Not only do they share similar emission sources, but they also influence and exacerbate each other. Joint action is an absolute must. In this regard, the United Nations, during its General Assembly session in last year, designated September 7th of every year as the International Day of Clean Air for Blue Skies, which was, in fact, proposed by the Korean President Moon Jae-in last year during the General Assembly. The International Day aims to raise solidarity for action against air pollution and climate change altogether, raising political momentum against the two global challenges. I am also looking into ways to raise awareness and participation of all stakeholders by collaborating in many international organizations like Boao Forum, where I'm working as a chairman, and also partnering for Green Growth and Global Goals Summit, P4G Summit, which will be held in the Republic of Korea in June. Therefore, I ask for your interest and support so that the International Day of the Clean Air for Blue Skies can advance global action and change against air pollution and climate change. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd also like to emphasize that dealing with climate change also includes adapting to a new way of life. The warming planet means that we can no longer maintain the way we live, the way we work, and the way we consume, and the way we produce. We have to change our behavioral pattern. It's not only industries where they emit the greenhouse gas emissions. It's not from our own lives, lifestyles. We also create a lot of problems, like a particulate matter, fine dust issues. Therefore, it is very important that we have to take very seriously to adapt to changing a situation. The adaptation, mitigation are two policy responses, but we have been spending more and more on only mitigation. It's very important to reduce the sources of greenhouse gas emissions, but at the same time, we have to adapt. Adaptation, this has just 10 letters. But the word adaptation seems so simple, but actually encompasses a lot. For example, adaptation means planting drought-resistant crops in highland, dry land, positioning trees along riverbanks, restoring mangrove forest, redesigning the way we build our cities, sustainable cities, reducing the deadly impact of soaring temperatures, and establishing an effective early warning system, how to make sure that people are aware of the imminent danger, that we have to establish an effective early warning system to save lives. All of this cannot be achieved without the support of collective action and adequate financial, practical, and innovatory resources. This is what led to the creation of recently the Global Commission on Adaptation. Now, I'm raising the awareness of the importance of how to adapt to this situation. I'm now working as one of the co-chairs together with Bill Gates and with Ms. Kristalina Georgieva, who is now new managing director of IMF. Three of co-chairing this, but I'm more involved in this because of their own responsibilities. Now, we are going to host a summit meeting after the very successful Global Action Summit meeting at the United Nations in September, on October 22nd, at the invitation of the Prime Minister of Netherlands. We are going to meet there at the heads of state and government level. And there will be many important international events, like the Adaptation Summit in Netherlands in October, then COP26 in Glasgow, November this year. Therefore, I'm asking all the leaders, government leaders, business leaders, civil society leaders to take part in these two very important events where we will really show our solidarity and joint action to address climate change. Ladies and gentlemen, let me just add some other important aspect of this issue. Another way we can ensure adaptation at a systemic scale is through education. After having served 10 years as a Secretary General, and after having spoken to many world leaders, business, political, and civil society leaders, I have realized now that I have been speaking only to those people who know already, but these people have regularly being changed. 5 years after President, Prime Minister, they are gone. Then new people come that we have to repeat and repeat. It's very important that from now on that we have to educate our young generation who will really be leading this world with a more sense of global citizenship. It's extremely important that we educate young people possibly from elementary school, elementary, middle, and high school. By the time they take charge of their leadership, community leadership, global leadership, national leadership, they will be much better equipped with the global citizenship, aware of the importance of living together with the environment. That's what I got inspiration from Greta Thunberg, 16-year-old girl. I saw her speaking out in front of 150 heads of state and government at the United Nations. She was speaking out. Look, because of your empty words, my future, my dreams were taken away. I will not forgive you. I will not forgive you. This is what she was saying. This kind of messages have been spread, and I'm very glad to tell you that for the first time, the Italian government has made it a rule, national rule, that all the school children from elementary, middle, high school will have to go through 33 hours education on environment. This is a national law. I have spoken to my president in Korea. I have met the deputy prime minister and education minister that South Korean government should make sure that change their curriculums. Then I'm asking Chinese and all these wherever I visit, I'm meeting the ministers, that they should educate the people. There was one, as early in 1992, in the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, the young girl who was just 12 years old, 7 Kulis Suzuki, said that losing my future is not like losing an election. The political leaders may win and lose election, but they are not responsible. But those young people will have to be responsible for their own future. Ladies and gentlemen, the rise of the climate youth movement has also made me realize that we need to provide green and climate-centered atmosphere for all these people. During my 2 terms as the UN Secretary General, I had spent a lot of time meeting with world leaders, political leaders, to discuss the ways to deter this. And I have visited almost all the places on the earth where I was able to see, witness myself, the impact of climate change. I visited Arctic North Pole 4 times, one time Antarctica. Have you ever seen any leader who has visited this North Pole and Arctic? I was sending out strong messages, standing on the Arctic ice, that ice is melting, glaciers are melting. Let us prevent from this sea level rising. This has been my own, you know, messages. Ladies and gentlemen, let me conclude. I cannot stress how important it is for us to unite and pursue collective action. When faced with such daunting challenges, it is tempting to shift the blames to others and turn blind eyes to the problems. However, playing the blame games is never the answer. I blame the President Trump, but it's not blaming just for the sake of blaming. I'm just urging him to show his global leadership based on global vision as a global leader of this world. It has already been more than 1 year. The IPCC has made such a warning statement. We have only 11 years to act. Before it is too late, we have to answer. Me versus you mentality has no meaning in climate action. Remember that it should be us versus climate change. This decade will be the final decade again, where we can turn the tide against irreversible destruction of our change climate. Ladies and gentlemen, again, last year, April, I had an opportunity of meeting Pope Francis in Rome. And we were discussing the climate issues because he was very much devoted and committed to climate change. He told me that God always forgives. A human being sometimes forgives. Sometimes nature never forgives. Nature never forgives. I think this is true. The nature goes its own way. They do not wait for humanity. We have to follow the voices and warning of nature before the nature rash hit us, like many things happening now. And therefore, ladies and gentlemen, let's work together to make this world better by addressing and taking climate action before it is too late. Thank you very much for your commitment.
ladies and gentlemen, students. Thank you for your welcome, and it's a pleasure to be back in Brookings and an honour to address you in such distinguished company, not least my fellow elder, Ban Ki-moon. Remember, as Jeff Feltman actually reminded us, he was my boss for three mandates in the United Nations, and now he's my deputy, and he's a very supportive deputy at that. I also have very happy memories of participating over a number of years at the annual Brookings Bloom Roundtable in Aspen, partly because the company is very good and we don't have to work too hard. We get the afternoons off and we can go for long walks in the Aspen hills. These are momentous times. The political dynamics unfolding on Capitol Hill will have a profound impact on how the United States is governed, its place in the world, and its influence on global debates. But, as Ban Ki-moon has so eloquently outlined, the world faces a challenge far greater than any political machinations in any country. The climate crisis must be the top priority for all leaders in 2020. It's not hyperbole to say that the fate of humanity as a whole rests on decisions taken this year. Yesterday, Ban Ki-moon and I attended the unveiling of the Doomsday Clock. Its hands now stand, as he said, at 100 seconds to midnight, meaning that in the view of the eminent women and men of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, we are closer than we have ever been to catastrophe. And it was actually very good that the four scientists that spoke at that occasion spoke so clearly and communicated so well the message of why on nuclear we're in such a bad position, on climate we're in such a difficult position, and we have these disruptive technologies that, and the undermining of science that is making it difficult to make good decisions. As the name suggests, the Bulletin has historically been concerned with the threat of nuclear war, but the climate crisis is cited as the other existential threat facing our planet. Both demand urgent, sustained, responsible leadership and action, and the time for talking is over. The science of the climate crisis makes it imperative that we implement in full the voluntary commitments of the 2030 Agenda with its 17 Sustainable Development Goals and the commitments in the Paris Climate Agreement. We need a bold new vision where every country, every city, and every corporation commits to being carbon neutral by 2050. We need a change of mindset to enable a just transition to clean energy in a way that allows us to stay at or below 1.5 degrees of warming. We need to put a proper price on carbon. Every country needs to take seriously the report of the Global Commission on Adaptation, which Ban Ki-moon was speaking about, and build resilience in communities for the new normal we are experiencing, an experience exemplified by the terrible bushfires in Australia. Every country needs to raise the level of its political ambition regarding the nationally determined contributions, climate plans, ahead of COP26 in Glasgow this November. And this has to include the United States, regardless of the policies of the current administration. Whilst I too continue to deplore President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Agreement as myopic and irresponsible, I've been heartened by the huge response from Americans of all backgrounds, from state governors and mayors to business leaders, labor unions, faith groups, women and youth activists who've declared that they are still in and are determined to push for real climate action. Indeed, I'm convinced that we will only generate the necessary momentum and political pressure on leaders if we combine a top-down and a bottom-up approach that brings together all key actors, from the young activists so powerfully exemplified by Greta Thunberg, Jamie Margolin, and Alexandria Villasenor, to central bankers and the heads of the world's top investment funds. The recent announcement by BlackRock CEO Larry Fink that the firm will no longer fund investments that, in quotes, present a high sustainability-related risk, including divesting $500 million from coal-related businesses, is an encouraging sign, as is the new climate special envoy role in March for Bank of England Governor Mark Carney. Last month, I attended the COP in Madrid, together with my fellow elder, Ricardo Lagos, former president of Chile. I met many young people there, and I was really struck by the fierce clarity of their arguments and their determination to secure their future, and the fact that they keep saying, don't listen to us, we're only children, listen to the science. Over and over again, that's what they say, listen to the science. We need their energy and their mobilization, but there's also another important pressure from the top down, from business and investment. And then, with this bottom up and top down, who remains in the middle? Governments. It is governments who need to be squeezed, because if we're not squeezing them, they're not going to move. They're going to continue with business as usual. They're going to continue to deny, because the reality is elected representatives have very short-term horizons. They're thinking of the next election, which may be 6 months away or at the most 5 years away. And they don't want to take hard decisions because they want to get re-elected. And that's a problem all over the world. So we have to put the squeeze bottom up with a broad movement and top down with investment and business, which is on the right side of this issue. We need to see climate change as an intergenerational injustice, as well as a crisis whose burden is felt the most by the people who have least contributed to rising emissions. Some small island states will literally disappear unless the richer industrialized countries take much more radical and urgent action to keep temperature rises to 1.5 degrees, including a definitive and wholesale move away from fossil fuel use, exploration, and extraction. There's a big gender dimension because of the different social roles of women and men in many countries. Women are on the front lines and have to try to build resilience when their communities are affected, and women leaders need to step up more on this crisis. Failure to act will be a terrible stain on the world's conscience and will mean any future reference to justice or common endeavour will ring hollow for the millions impoverished and displaced by the climate catastrophe. This is why a multilateral approach is essential, where the leaders of the rich and powerful countries, such as the G20, take the lead, not only in a spirit of solidarity, but also from enlightened self-interest. The challenge now is to increase ambition, which means keeping the G20 and its finance ministers closely connected to the UN's climate agenda. Nowhere is this more critical than the debate on fossil fuels. We've actually entered a new reality where fossil fuel companies are losing their legitimacy and social license to operate. If governments are to retain their own legitimacy and trust among citizens, this means they must end all fossil fuel subsidies in all forms, so coal and other hydrocarbons are kept in the ground and resources are invested instead in clean, renewable energy sources and green technologies. We need action to deliver a truly just transition so that regions and communities previously reliant on fossil fuel production for jobs and broader economic and social structures are not abandoned, that workers' rights and dignity are respected, and that new opportunities are provided through investment and education for current and future generations. We also need the fossil fuel and finance industries to make a firm and clear commitment to halt any and all plans for future fossil fuel extraction, whether through drilling, mining, fracking, or any other form, and to develop a comprehensive, transparent database of all existing fossil fuel assets and reserves. A publicly accessible registry, whether state or investor-owned, would enable all stakeholders to organise a new plan for an orderly wind-down of pending or proposed projects, a just transition, in other words. It would give clarity to investors who hold an extraordinary latent power to further the sustainability agenda and thus secure a long-term future for their own assets and investment strategies. There is, of course, an irony that this year's G20 presidency is held by Saudi Arabia, a state whose entire economy is based on fossil fuels. But I hope that this apparent dissonance will actually concentrate minds in all G20 states to work together to develop new sustainable economic and industrial models that are compatible with a net zero world. I actually know for a fact that Saudi Arabia can switch very rapidly to solar when it wants to. I was on the board of the King Abdullah University for Science and Technology for a number of years in Saudi Arabia. And it was a new university with a very, very big endowment from the then king. And it had all the money in the world for whatever research it wanted. And what did it want? Research on solar. It bought the research from this country on solar. It has wonderful sun and it has very good sand for making the chips. So believe me, there will be no problem when the time comes. But meanwhile, there's profit to be made, as we know. So that's the problem. And this debate must not just be restricted to the G20. We need an inclusive global mobilization with the United Nations playing a leading role. A few weeks ago, I had the honor of addressing the UN Security Council as chair of the elders at a session on the future of the UN Charter, 75 years after the organization's founding. The Council should be a key player in shaping the new global mindset on climate justice and climate action. But unfortunately, it's seen by many as not being fit for purpose. Too many members, not least those with the special responsibility of holding permanent seats, treat it as a forum for advancing their own narrow interests rather than a means of addressing common challenges. So we have a challenge, and this year 2020 is absolutely key. From the East River to the Potomac and the shores beyond, a radical change is needed in 2020. As elders, we were actually mandated by Nelson Mandela to bring hope. And as Mandela put it succinctly, it always seems impossible until it is done. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, President Robinson and Secretary Bond, for joining us today. This was truly inspirational for me, and I'm very honored and privileged to be up here on the stage with you. And I also have the privilege of asking you a couple of questions to get us started, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. So, and thanks to all of you for joining us. Thank you for those comments. I thought you as the elders and as global leaders are doing your part in education and encouraging multilateral international organizations. But when we, as both of you have mentioned, some of the climate changes, the climate events that are happening are daunting. Mozambique to Haiti, Bahamas, Australia. The floodings in Houston and the Midwestern states, the erosion of the permafrost in Alaska, all of those things seem to be happening with more frequency, with more devastation, with hundreds of billions of dollars in damage. And so all of that seems very daunting. How do we absorb all of this crisis? And I think what we have in the audience is that the audience members are also asking for, how do we deal with this? So you mentioned BlackRock, you mentioned Microsoft. These are big companies. Saudi Arabia can also do something as a government. The Trump administration can obviously make a political commitment. But I also wonder, as you talk about the top-down and bottom-up, what can we do in addition to supporting and educating ourselves on a micro level? How does the bottom up and the top down meet? And I wonder, President Robinson, if you might address that.
Well, I like to say to people what they can do, which is three steps. And the first step is to make climate change, the climate crisis. I don't even talk about climate change anymore. The climate crisis, the climate emergency, personal in your own life. You've got to do that.
which means you're going to do something you weren't doing before. And I give the example, I've become a pescatarian. I've given up meat about a year and a half ago. I still, you know, I still have withdrawal from time, but anyway. The second step is to get angry and get active. Get angry about those with more responsibility who aren't meeting their responsibility, and get active supporting those who are on the right side of this, on conservation, on advocacy, on all the things that can be done. And the third thing, and actually this is the most important, we have to imagine this world that we need to be hurrying towards. Because, as we've heard, we've both been saying this, we have 10 years. You know, we have to be in a much different place. We have to have 45% reduction in global emissions by 2030. That's a very short time. So that's why Greta Thunberg is so frustrated in Davos. She says there's lots of talk, but there's no action. We're not seeing that bend at the curve. But in order to get a sense of enthusiasm about it, we have to imagine this world. It'll be a much healthier world. We won't have the particle problem that Ban Ki-moon was talking about. We won't have that, you know, the fossil fuel air and water pollution. We have to have a much more equal world because we'll have to have implemented the Sustainable Development Goals, leaving no one behind. And with the gender equality, goal 10 on equality between countries and within countries and so on, and oceans and all of those things, and biodiversity. So, you know, I think we really need young people to think about that world they want to see and pressure us to get there more quickly.
And I think what comes through in both of your comments today is that, yes, there is a crisis. And Secretary General Ban, you mentioned that we talk a lot about mitigation, and that's the sense of crisis, and that we have to try to stop things from happening. But you also talked about adaptation, which brings us to from a narrative of crisis to a narrative of opportunity in climate change. Will you talk more about sustainable development and how that is an opportunity for all of us?
If we are able to meet the target of all Agenda 2030, I think that will be fine. But the implementation level, depending upon where you are living, is quite different. Likewise, in the addressing the climate actions is, again, hugely different. The countries with the resources, I think they are doing all, trying to transition from fossil fuel energy to sustainable energy, etc. But there are many poor countries, as you mentioned, Africa and Southeast Asia, Latin America, and South Pacific small developing island state. They simply don't have any resources. That's why the U.S. and European Union and Japan, at the time of negotiation, they pledged that from this year, up to this year, 2020, they will mobilize $100 billion every year. Then thereafter, $100 billion every year to support developing countries financially. But this Green Climate Fund is almost empty shell now because of non-implementation of their promises, starting from the United States. United States is not paying, at least one-third is lacking. The European Union is not following. Japan is not following. So OECD is not following. And then it has just merely few billion dollars. That's the reality. Then we must use all high technology, 21st century technology, to address climate phenomena. Then we have to really mobilize the power of business community, global business communities, which can really take much, much more important contribution, much more than the government can do. It's, you know, they have to really show their global responsibility as global corporations. That's what I am asking. But there is clearly lack of united will of the international community. Now, when United States is away out of this, then we are missing huge pillar. Now, who is leading this?
U.S. has been leading. Then when U.S. is not there, then who can expect to lead this one? Do you expect China will lead this one? Or European Union is also divided. So that's why I'm very much worried that the things are not moving as has been promised. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there should be a political leadership now.
Both of you talked about unity, political leadership, collective action, and having a common goal and being very focused on this. But as you know, the Trump administration's approach is America first. And we have a rise of populism and authoritarianism in Europe and in all parts of the world. And I wonder, how do we get to that point, given this trend and the rise of authoritarianism? I'm talking about, for example, the Amazon is burning, and the Amazon is being depleted at an alarming rate. And yet, when the global community said something about it, the pushback was severe. Our country. We're a sovereign nation. We can do what we want. And so when we talk about global unity, how do we deal with that in the age of America first, or in the age of authoritarianism, or in the rise of populism and entrenched interests that are hard to move?
It's certainly true that we are in a difficult time of undermining multilateral cooperation. And these elders actually made a strong statement last December. And we called out the United States as being probably the worst offender, if you like, in that regard. But there are other countries as well. And you mentioned the Amazon, and we know that Brazil is part of that. But actually, I think we can learn a lesson from the way young people are organizing with their Fridays for Future. I have been incredibly impressed. I was moderating a panel in Madrid in which I had five young people, and I mean 14, 15, 16, 17, and five government ministers who were on the right side of the issues. They had committed to a declaration on the importance of remembering children in particular with the Sustainable Development Goals. And the children were asking questions of the ministers, and then the ministers could ask of the children. And at one point, a 14-year-old from Norway had asked a question, and clearly she wasn't satisfied with the answer. I said, "Do you want to come back?" And then it just took off. And what those children said, I will never forget. They said, "We are bonded by the fact that all over the world, we know we don't have a future unless things change. And that has made us have a huge solidarity and even love for those who are most affected in our world." It was, you know, it was just... it was like listening to the implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals by the young people who are aware of this bond between them. And that's what's happening. And that's what's happening. That's what, you know, the marches in Davos, because Greta Thunberg was there with her leadership of, there are various names. She's not the only one, and she keeps trying to, you know, get away from just mentioning her. But the point is, they get it. And they say, as I said, listen to the science. And they have understood the science. It's not hard for them to understand it. It's accessible to them. And the science is frightening at that age, unless you do something. So I think there's an opportunity in the very climate crisis. You know, I think there's an opportunity because actually we don't have any choice. And it's manifesting itself. When a first world country like Australia is burning, and then when the rains come, the dust in the rivers kills the fish, and it's worse and worse and worse.
Let me add to multilateralism. Again, another deepest worrying situation is that the multilateralism symbolized by, represented by the United Nations, is now under serious attack by those countries, including the United States, which have been really most supported and in their global leadership based on universal values and principles on human rights and peace and security, equality. I think the United States has been just respected as a leader of this world, and multilateralism has been respected.
multilateralism, particularly since the end of Second World War, has been the guiding framework, global framework, under which and within which countries big and small, people rich and poor, have been protected and supported with due respect, sovereignty, etc. Now, you talk about America first, my country first, protectionism, individualism, isolationist. Look at what had happened in 1930s when U.S. took isolationist policies. It has led to the collapse of League of Nations, that it has led the surge of what is the Nazism and fascism. Then Second World War broke out. There was no peacekeeping or stability, no force. Now, only with having experienced such a tragic consequences during Second World War, people came to realize that we have to work together, big and small. And U.S. has been, by any standard, without any questions, has been playing a leadership role. And people accepted it. Now, UN, the U.S. has been withdrawing from, most importantly, Human Rights Council, then UNESCO, then they have abrogated the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran. They have withdrawn from the biggest and most important global agreement on climate change. Now, what kind of lessons are we going to learn from this? The people say that children learn from their parents. When parents give good lessons by their own behavior, you don't need to teach. By just acting, mother and father, by acting, the children learn. And people learn from the global leaders. When global leaders are not acting responsibly, and then you will see a lot of divisions, and isolationist policies. And then you will see unwanted situation, ISIS or extremist forces. So this world is now experiencing continuing sources of conflict here and there. And therefore, I think we have to really work together. The global leaders should show global vision based on global citizenship. There is no such United States, Japan, Korea. We are living in a small planet Earth. There is no country in this world where you cannot arrive within 24 hours. Our message can be transferred within a fraction of a second to the end of the world. So that means we are just one citizen, one global citizen. Then you act differently, then you are giving very bad messages to our succeeding generation. I think we have a moral responsibility. And political leaders, they have political leadership to make this world better, where we can live sustainably with all human rights respected, rich and poor. Now, we have to really be more compassionate to those people who are really suffering. Particularly on climate change, those countries who have contributed least to the consequences of climate are being affected worst, most. Those countries who have contributed most to the climate phenomena, they have resources. They can be much better off than those people. It's a matter of what Mary Robinson said, climate justice. This is an issue of justice. This is an issue of science. This is an issue of morality and science. So I'm really urging world leaders, particularly political leaders, they have shown good example. They should lead by example. That's my answer, as former Secretary General. I'm really appealing. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. I was really interested in what you said about Spain having a new curriculum. Having a new curriculum to require some hours on climate change and climate science, and that you're encouraging the South Korean government to do so. So, as well as the global leadership that I think President Robinson and Secretary General Ban provide, and the moral leadership, I think that you've both made the case for the economic leadership as well, and that there are economic costs at the very... So all of these climate change things that are happening are felt at the local level, right? Rich and poor, the least developed islands are obviously feeling the pinch, but also the wealthy are feeling the pinch. You mentioned Aspen. Colorado, because of the lack of snow, has opened up its first soup kitchen in the past couple of years. And Napa Valley, another area of wealth, has also suffered devastating fires. So I think at the global level, there is a moral leadership, but the effects are felt at the local level as well, and that provides this wellspring of some new ideas for what to do. I want to now open it up to the audience. I'll take three at a time. I would ask that since we're running out of time, that you introduce yourself very quickly and make sure to ask a question rather than a comment. So let me do woman up front in the pink, woman also in the pink, and is there another pink? Woman in the middle with the glasses. So up here first.
Hi, thank you so much for the wonderful sharing. I think we've all learned a lot about it. My name is Angel, and I'm with Hong Kong Phoenix Television. I actually used to work in the United Nations Secretariat in your last year in 2016, and I have also worked in WFP in Rome before. So my question is, it seems like everyone seems worried about climate change and nuclear weapons. And as you have said before, the government, the states seems worried. They all talk about it inside of the United Nations, but when they left, they forget about it. How do we ensure the effectiveness and efficiency of what the UN has been putting into agenda can actually be achieved? How do we ensure the effectiveness and efficiency? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Pink again.
Good morning, Sanjin Choi, Langham Partners. Thank you so much for lucid and succinct and straightforward remarks. My question to you, President Robinson, you mentioned about a lot of central bank and financial institutions. You are absolutely right. Mark Carney has been forward thinking and the lot of central bank, but I'm not sure his incoming governor, Andrew Bailey, will do the same things. But with regard to your remark, BlackRock. Of course, BlackRock managed $7 trillion. However, last year when I was in BlackRock in London, and there was a huge demonstration, so perhaps maybe something changed Larry Fink's heart. But when you mentioned Norway has the largest sovereign wealth fund, managed $1 trillion. Government decided to divert some of the fundings, but not everything. And I would be interested in your views, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. You know Middle East very well. Of course, Kingdom of Saudi will host the G20. At the moment, the president of Development Bank is a former Saudi Arabia minister, and most of the Islamic Development Bank is dealing with infrastructure funding issues. I would be interested in your views of GCC sovereign wealth funding with regard to the climate change. Thank you very much.
So your question is about the role of climate or sovereign risk funds on climate change and what they can do. Got it. Okay. Middle, yes.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for being here. It's such an honor. My name is Roshni. I'm a student at Harvard University. I'm very concerned about the forced displacement caused by climate change, and numbers have been thrown around 200 million by 2050. And my question has two parts. So the first is, do you think there's hope for the 1951 Refugee Convention to be amended to include climate refugees? And the second part is, what is a sustainable way in which to resettle these populations? Because a lot of countries have begun buying land in Fiji, for example, So, but that doesn't really seem sustainable. So what is a sustainable way in which to resettle these massive numbers of people?
So we have three questions. One is on how do we ensure the efficiency of UN-type mechanisms and how the implementation of what is agreed on at the UN. Secondly, what is the role of sovereign wealth funds and in their role in mitigating and adapting to climate change? And three, what do we do about forced displacement, which is happening now, the climate refugees and the issue of land use? So I welcome you. Don't have to answer all three. Just
Let me answer about the effectiveness of the United Nations. I have been receiving this kind of question so many times during my time. So my answer is that the UN is not the perfect one. I admit it. But at this time, that's the maximum where member states' will and commitment have been there. But that does not give us any complacency. You know, I have been very strong, very firm, to make United Nations more accountable, responsible, morally, clean and effective. That's why I really try to change the administrative structures. I think a lot of changes have been made during my time, including just to make morally clean, ethically clean. UN. We have learned a lot from a so-called oil for food crisis. That was a corruptive practices. Then we have not seen any such kind of very serious issues. At the same time, how to make sure that the UN staff, particularly leading staff, they should lead by example, by showing good example, not only to the staff, but also to the world, so that the UN is working in a accountable way. That's what I can tell you at this time. I'm sure that my successor, Antonio Guterres, will be much more based on what I have achieved. That's what I can tell you. Let me go to number three, refugees. There are many reasons why people become refugees. Most of them, they are driven, forced to flee their country of their home because of imminent danger to their lives, like a conflict, as you see in Syria. I think at least 5 million people have become refugees now. We have 75 million refugees around the world. That is the number of refugees where there was only during the Second World War. During peacetime, 21st century, it's impossible to understand. It's unacceptable to recognize that there are 75 million people. Why? Because of the domestic problems, they leave their country because of the conflict, because of the poverty, long spell of drought or flooding, natural disasters. There are many reasons. Now, UNHCR, which was led once by Antonio Guterres, current Secretary General, we've been mobilizing all necessary support. I have convened so many refugee support donor conferences so many times, but still, clearly, there is a lack of support from the member state. Instead of helping refugees, many leaders are erecting walls to prevent the refugees from entering to a safer place. I've been really speaking out that, dear leaders, please do not erect walls. Instead, you must build bridges among people instead of rejecting them. And if you reject them, where can they go? We lose a lot of children who have to die needlessly because of these problems. Therefore, again, there is a clearly moral deficiencies at this time, political moral deficiencies
among the leaders, some well-to-do European countries, they just prohibit the people from coming. And some leaders are now threatening to release refugees to other countries. This has become quite political issues. Again, this is a source of concern that I hope that, again, the U.S. should really show a global leadership. Thank you.
President Robinson.
Okay. I wouldn't dream of attempting the first question after the Secretary General, so I'll, I'll focus on the second question, and I also want to add something to what Ban Ki-moon said about the third question on climate-displaced people and refugees. On the sovereign funds, I think the main problem now is countries are committing to be zero carbon by 2050, and the United Kingdom, for example, has actually put it into law to their great credit. But the United Kingdom is, with its export credit, funding fossil fuel elsewhere. And I gather there was a big African meeting in London the other day, and most of the investment was in fossil fuel in Africa. So that's not really very helpful. Norway has just got a big oil field that's coming on stream, and they're very proud of the fact that they're using clean energy to bring the oil on stream, and then they'll export the oil, and it won't be their problem. That's not on. We can't have that anymore. We've got to get real about this, and I think that's really very important. On the climate displaced, there's actually a good piece of news, thanks to the UN Human Rights Committee. Just the other day, there was a case of a person from Kiribati, the small island atolls of Kiribati. He was on one of the smaller atolls that went under, so he had to move to a slightly higher atoll, which was overcrowded. So he fled, basically, to New Zealand and brought a claim that he shouldn't be sent out of New Zealand because he was a climate-displaced forced person. The court, on the evidence, didn't uphold his claim, but they did uphold in law that a person who is forced to leave and cannot live because of climate conditions cannot be forced to return. That's very important. That's the beginnings of a human rights approach to... I still don't say climate refugees. I say climate displaced people because they haven't got the status of refugees. Now they've begun to get a little bit of status thanks to the Human Rights Committee, and I think we can build on that. And that's good news. And the UN has done something good.
I want to get two more. Woman in beige and gentleman in the purple shirt back there. Again, your name, affiliation, and a very brief question.
Thank you. My name is Shamini Selvaratnam, and my question is, you mentioned about all of the things that we talked about, protectionism, individualism, climate skepticism, climate denialism. These things are funded and by actors who benefit from climate inaction, from business as usual. How do we address that? Because, you know, Mary Robinson, in her three things that we as individuals can do, that's great, but how do we combat the active actors who are working against our collective interest?
Thank you. Oh, no. Yeah, there was a gentleman in the purple shirt in front of you, in front of you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Aristotle Vinikos. I'm an undergraduate at Harvard. We talked a lot about science and in the role of science in legitimizing the climate emergency. But when we talked about actually solving the problem, we mentioned the role of government and in private institutions. I'm wondering how you envision the role of science and innovation technology in allowing us to actually combat the issue as well and promote new solutions, maybe in continual, you know, clean energies, things like that, that will allow us to promote change as well.
So I feel terrible. Thank you. So I feel terrible. So please.
Rick Rybak with Just Economics. Thank you for the great presentations and insights. Question, in the United States and around the world, our development patterns are characterized by something we call suburban sprawl. And development is very spread out. It results in very energy inefficient dwellings and requires people to travel in energy efficient modes. I'm wondering what you see as a way to remedy suburban sprawl. Are there certain techniques or things that we can do so that our settlement patterns are more compact and more compatible with saving both the countryside and our cities?
Great, thank you. So we have three questions. One is, how do we talked about the trends on protectionism, how do we combat entrenched, funded interests that are solidly on the side of the status quo? Secondly, what is the role of science and innovation? And I think the third question actually does relate to the science and innovation question, which is, what are we doing with development of combating sprawl, and how do we design cities? You can answer one or any of those questions.
The first question will have to be much to fostering global citizenship. We see many national leaders with just aiming for short-term gain, short-term political gains, so electoral gains. And this really hampers and really makes serious problems. A lot of leaders claim that they are global leaders. They work for the world. But in reality, almost all of them, almost without exception, they become national leaders with the small sense of global vision. European Union, they always say global vision. American leaders, most of them, except some developing countries, but the way they do is very, very disappointing. So that is why, based on my experience, then the first thing I did after my retirement is to establish a Ban Ki-moon Center for Global Citizens. Global citizen. Because I've been always feeling that this is because of lacking of global citizenship by the leaders who claim to be global leaders. I think that's the answer. It's an easy answer, but very difficult. How to teach, how to educate these people? So normally, we use such a forum like the United Nations, but I do not have any such kind of forum now. I'm just speaking out alone. But still, I am doing more for young people, just starting from young people, fostering global citizenship. That's my answer at this time. Of course, there is a clearly very important role of science. But in the other aspect, there is another some issues of how you use science and technology for proper purpose. That is what we need to really have some global governance system. Suppose AI, artificial intelligence, it can be used. There is a serious morality issues. Should human being become slaves or dictated by what machine says? No, that's not. We have to control. We have to be able to control the use of this science. When it comes to disruptive technologies, how can you make sure that these disruptive sciences are not used by terrorists or some other people who have ill motives? So there should be, again, United Nations. There is a lot of things for United Nations to do with the future technology. Maybe I'm leaving again. You know.
On the climate skeptics, yes, there are big funders and a lot of money going into climate skeptics. And I think the advice is follow the money and challenge the large fossil fuel companies that are funding
the skepticism, the bad science, etc. They're still doing it. So that's the way to address that. And you know, I served for 9 years on the European Climate Foundation, and the European Climate Foundation tracked the funding of the skepticism and the denial, the bad science. And it is millions and millions every year. And then the money to counter it is a million or two. You know, it's far, far less. But actually, the European Climate Foundation has become more effective in addressing some of the climate denial and also making sure the good science gets well covered and gets out. And this is important. But, you know, it's a tough world because the money is on the bad side. And I learned something. I mean, I'm not letting Ban Ki-moon away with the Pope. I was with the Pope as well. I was at a second convening by the Vatican of the oil and gas heads of companies, and they were all there, including the heads of ExxonMobil, BP, Total, Shell, you name it, and the investors in the oil and gas companies. The first convening the year before had been a total failure. The Pope had not been pleased. He made a strong statement and left with no photographs, which devastated those who had come. So they were on their better behaviour, and they signed up to weak agreements on carbon pricing and carbon risk disclosure. And they all signed, and then they got their photo, etc. But the point is, what really came home to me, and it's a very obvious thing, but I hadn't understood it properly, is you make billions from fossil fuel. You make millions from clean energy. So how do you go from billions to millions without disruption? So the only way we're going to get the change in the fossil fuel-led economy, which we still have, and start to bend that curve, is through disruption. It's through the work of the school children, the Extinction Rebellion, the Sunrise Movement in this country, but it's also litigation, like the Urgenda case, the other cases that are pending, the Children's Trust case in Oregon and all other cases. It's through shareholders questioning in things. It's through... most of us have bank accounts, I think. We could all challenge our banks. I have a podcast called Mothers of Invention, and the byline of the podcast is that climate change is a man-made problem and requires a feminist solution. And, you know, for the men in the room who might feel a bit uncomfortable, let me explain that man-made is generic and a feminist solution definitely includes men and hopefully all the men in the room. And I'm doing it with a younger Irish woman who's a very successful comedian based in New York, Maeve Higgins. And Maeve rang her bank up because Chase Bank, she discovered, when she learned a little bit about climate through our podcast, was very invested in fossil fuel. So the thrust of the phone call was that she wanted to withdraw her money. And the poor woman she was talking to had no idea how to deal with this and said, well, look, you better get on to headquarters. And Maeve said very politely, yes, I'll do that. Now, tell me, I'm in New York phoning you. Where are you? And the woman said, oh, I'm in the Philippines. Oh, says Maeve, I gather climate is very difficult in the Philippines. And for the next 10 minutes, the woman talks about you know, we can all ring our bank and, you know, ask them about their fossil fuel. In other words, there are things you can do to make the disruption, make life more uncomfortable for those on the wrong side of all of this. So I don't want to go on for too long. Yes, I totally agree about the science and innovation. I also agree with the point that Ban Ki-moon was making. We need to be worried about when we get more urgent, which we will over the next decade. We'll get very urgent about climate because it's going to get worse and worse. And if we don't see the bending of the curve, then we'll get more urgent. And then we'll start having technical geoengineering solutions. And we have no governance at the moment of geoengineering. So that's an issue which the elders have been thinking about. And the final one on the suburban sprawl, I think, you know, to me, that's a matter of planning regulations. And I think, you know, the diminishing of regulations generally on water quality, on air quality that are in this country is very distressing, to be honest. And I think the planning regulations are probably in the same. I'm not an expert on that area. But it's better if you have planning. We're going to need to refit old buildings to make them energy efficient because buildings contribute hugely to emissions. Refitting old buildings that people live in is very costly, and we haven't worked out how we're going to do it. So that's a huge problem, which every country will need to think about.
We started late, so we are ending a little bit late. Thank you all of you for your time and your attention and your wonderful questions. Thank you, President Robinson and Secretary General Vaughn, for your leadership and for your vision.
Thank you.